Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. It's been 2 years since Russia began a brutal invasion of Ukraine, an action that Vladimir Putin still requires Russian citizens to refer to as a special military operation. In an interview on Sunday, Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said that 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died in the conflict. At least that many civilians have perished as well, and many others have been injured. Estimates of Russian casualties vary widely, but U.S. intelligence sources and the U.N. put the number near 100,000. The U.S. House of Representatives has stalled American funding for the Ukraine war effort at the behest of Donald Trump. President Biden is meeting today with the top leaders from the House and Senate to try to work through that impasse to fund not only the Ukraine resistance, but Israel and Taiwan as well. The leaders will also discuss ways to avert a partial government shutdown, the deadline for which is Friday. With Ukrainian fighters rationing ammunition, Russian forces have made gains in recent days, and there appears to be some substantial support for the war among the Russian people. But there is also substantial opposition to not just the war, but to Putin's regime in general. Some 1 million Russians have fled the country to avoid being sent to the front lines and to work in exile to end the Putin autocracy. My guest today is Paul Starobin, a former Moscow bureau chief for Business Week, who has reported extensively on Russia for more than 25 years. His new book chronicles the extent and the efficacy of the movement to oppose Putin. It's called Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. Paul Starobin joins us on Zoom from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
So what's your take on the death numbers that were reported this weekend? Volodymyr Zelensky said for the first time 31,000 Ukrainian troops had perished in the conflict. That was the first time we'd heard an official government estimate from President Zelensky. What's your take on numbers of military, numbers of civilians in Ukraine, numbers of Russians? Is there any way of really understanding the scope of this carnage?
I think it's probably greater. I think it's significant that Zelensky did not mention casualties, I believe, only the killed. So I think that the numbers are probably much greater than that, if we consider killed and wounded, and among civilians perhaps as well. The Russians, they have not released any real figures either. And it's generally seen that they have been more willing to take casualties, the Russians, than the Ukrainians have. And I think that's true. And I think that's long been true, really, of Russian warfighting methods.
And of course, you know, when it comes to Russian dissidents, Alexei Navalny, very much in the news because he died in an Arctic prison while, you know, in the custody of the Russian government. Yes. Circumstances are very murky about the conditions of his death. What can you tell us about what we know about Navalny's passing? Was it a murder? Was it an illness that, you know, occurred because of the mistreatment he's endured for all these years? I mean, do we know anything about the circumstances of his death?
We don't really know the particulars, but I think it's fair to say that this is a state-sanctioned or ordered murder, whether it, the fatal blow was struck just, you know, when he died, just before, or even, you know, years before, when the security services of Russia, I think, are reliably said to have poisoned Navalny with Novichok when he was in Siberia. This was before the February 2022 invasion of Ukraine by Russia. Navalny went to Germany to recover, and then he made his fateful decision to come back to Russia, knowing that he would be jailed. And the other thing that's intriguing that's come up is that the Navalny organization has said that Navalny, Alexei, was going to be the subject, or was the talk of a swap that would take place for a Russian prisoner now in Germany. And independently, through a source very close to the Navalny organization, I have been able to confirm that there were such talks and that Alexei was willing to be swapped, in fact.
And that trade deal allegedly also would have included Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter, and Paul Whelan, a former Marine who's been held, you know, for a long time. So, you make the case at the very beginning of the book. You say that the argument is that the rebellion of Putin's exiles has the potential to achieve its objective of a better Russia. And I was struck by that while I was reading your book and listening to the news and reading the news about Navalny's death. Why did Navalny go back? I mean, knowing his fate was surely going to be certainly imprisonment, if not ultimately death. What do you think he thought he could achieve by returning to Russia that he couldn't achieve living in Germany or someplace else and operating as an exile?
So a close friend of Navalny who knew him for a very long time and helped to fund his organization told me that Alexei going back from Germany to Russia was a quote-unquote deep philosophical act on Alexei's part. And it was due in part to a religious conversion that Navalny himself has spoke of publicly when he returned. He said, "I am now a Christian," by which he meant in some kind of fundamental way he was identifying with a kind of a Christian saga where he would be persecuted and he would suffer, but in a kind of symbolic way, it would be for Russia. I mean, there was a kind of an identification of Alexei, I think, with the Russian nationhood, which appealed to a lot of people in Russia and I think set him apart from many others. It was an act of personal bravery and courage on his part, and it was an act of defiance against Putin, who surely did not want him to return and expected him to be marginalized in outside of Russia, as a number of the exiles have been. So I think a number of things went into that, but it was certainly a kind of a deliberate and calculated decision on his part that to him certainly was fateful. I think he expected to die at some point in Russia, and he prophesized it, really, and then it happened.
So you think it's more emotional and philosophical than strategic? I mean, is Putin right to have thought if he's in Germany or, you know, someplace out of Russia, he would be marginalized and his efficacy and his impact would be attenuated significantly?
I think that Alexei felt that he could, in Russia, be a kind of focal point for the resistance that was forming, including by his organization, outside of Russia. I don't think it's true that Putin perhaps thought that Alexei would have been marginalized outside of Russia. But at the same time, I think, as we have seen, and I discuss in my book, Putin feels threatened by these exiles, by the Russian diaspora that has gathered against him, that feeds a lot of information. It's kind of an information warfare in the Russian language back to Russia against Putin, against the war. And Putin has been trying to extend his repressive net outside of Russia to capture these exiles, for example, to crack down on prominent singers and comedians who are anti-Putin, who want to perform for Russians in the diaspora. So the fight is really extended across Russia's borders, and it includes now the Navalny organization, which is headed, at least nominally, by his widow, Yulia.
If you've just joined us, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Paul Starobin. He is the author of a terrific new book called Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. So let's talk about this diaspora. You estimate that as many as a million Russians, have left Russia since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Yes. Has that exodus, you know, continued at a steady drip? I mean, it sounds like a lot of people left right at the beginning of the war. The intensity of the exodus, been sustained throughout the 2 years of the conflict?
No, there was initially, after the really all-out invasion by Putin 2 years ago in February 2022, there was a first wave of people who left almost immediately. I think that was highly political in nature. I mean, these consisted of people in cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg who were already actively involved in some way against the Putin regime, and they figured their name was probably on a list. and they better get out of the country. Then, months later, Putin called for a mobilization of Russian troops to go to the front. So all of the people who thought they would be caught in that net and who did not want to go to the front, it might have been political, it might have been simply they didn't see this as a war that they wanted to die for, which in a way is political, those people left. So you had those two very large waves. Since then, there's been a lot of expectation that Putin would put in for another mobilization of troops, but that would be politically unpopular. It hasn't happened yet. And so I don't think we're going to get another sort of fresh exodus out of Russia unless that order is put in.
And put that number in context for us, the million or so Russians who've left. In terms of a population of 143 million people, the 1 million, leaves an awful lot of people behind, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. And it's not an easy decision to make. I mean, for many people, people in the tech community, these are among the people who left. It's estimated that up to 10% of Russians' tech workers left. I mean, these are fairly, as you can imagine, people who can work remotely. I mean, it's not, they don't really have to give up their livelihood in leaving Russia. But for many others, it's really not like that. And the condition of exile, as I talk in the book, is, a pretty indeterminate one. I mean, you're in some place, you're outside of your home, you may not have home country access to funds, you may not have a job, your residency status may not be determined. So it's not necessarily the happiest of conditions. So many people, choose to stay in Russia. Most people, of course, but still, 1 million people is not a small number.
Is there any appreciable impact on the Russian economy because of the kinds of people who've left? You mentioned the 10% of tech workers. You profile a prominent economist who's in exile. There are journalists who are that you profile in the book. Is there a way of calculating what this has meant to the Russian economy?
Well, I think it's difficult, and I think initially the economy certainly suffered, and we saw that, for example, in the exchange rate of the ruble. But in very crude and basic terms, so much of the Russian economy is of a natural resource extraction type. In other words, oil and gas and, basic commodities, which, even though sanctions have been applied by Europe and the United States, exports of those commodities continue, and there are many buyers, China, India, Russian, oil refined products are in fact moving back to Europe. At the same time, Russia is able to import a lot of things indirectly through former Soviet republics, for example. So I don't think the economy has suffered nearly as much as people in Washington and the European capitals expected and hoped that it would. At the same time, absolutely, Russia has lost a real sort of cream of the crop in terms of its creative people, the creative class, cultural leaders, singers, economists, many, many academics who have left. I was recently told by a person who left that colleagues back in Russia were scrambling, to recruit other teachers, professors, in some cases very unqualified ones for jobs because there are so few people left because so many of those people were gone. So I would think we would see kind of a longer term effect in those terms.
If sanctions have in fact had, a minimal effect on the economy, and the president just implemented or announced 500 new sanctions following the death of Alexei Navalny, what kind of leverage, if the sanctions aren't going to achieve what folks had hoped they would achieve, what kind of leverage does the United States and the European community and the world community have against Vladimir Putin?
I don't think the United States and the world community have a tremendous amount of leverage against Putin because they've basically have tried everything and they've all but called him a war criminal, and in some cases have called him a war criminal, but it's not like they're going to be able to bring him to justice in The Hague anytime soon. He would have to be toppled. At the same time, they've focused on helping Ukraine. As we know, that's now tied up in Congress in Washington. So their greatest leverage in that case would be to assist the Ukrainian military as much as possible and, with Putin, you have to take, strength against strength. So he would have to suffer, I think, on the battlefield in order for there to be any greater leverage in those kinds of terms. I think the opposition, though, is playing on a different kind of, playing field. It's not about that kind of leverage.
Yeah, and you also make an interesting point that had escaped me, although it probably shouldn't have, with the example of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the military sort of mercenary leader of part of the troops in Ukraine. There is a flank to Putin's right that is in opposition to his conduct of the war. It's not just the left. Tell us about the ultra-conservative opposition to Putin's execution of this war.
Yeah, well, it's a very motley crew, as you say, Tom. I mean, it just goes all the way across the ideological spectrum. On the right, you see right-wing nationalists, basically, which, would not be unfamiliar characters, as we've seen in Europe. We've seen, there are some even in Ukraine who basically think that Putin has not, gone far enough in prosecuting the war. You see such people among military bloggers associated or tied to the Russian military. Lately, Putin has cracked down on them because, just as he doesn't tolerate opposition from the middle of the political spectrum or of the left, he doesn't tolerate it on the right either, and he doesn't want that right-wing faction to get out of control. But some of that faction has become militant, and that's another thing. The opposition, my feeling is that with Navalny's death, the opposition itself is going to take a more militant turn.
Paul Starobin, his new book is called Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. We'll have more with Paul Starobin on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Here's some music that has become an anthem of sorts for the resistance movement in Russia. It's by a singer named Monichotka. The title translates to Outlast. Stay with us.
Меня не раз кусали акулы, меня не раз кусали собаки, я гуляла в грозу с металлическим жестом.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, it's another installment of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. The White House is announcing today a $1.7 billion program to address hunger in the United States. So we'll talk about what that program entails and what needs to be done to move the needle on food insecurity. Plus, Nick Team of the Baltimore Banner will tell us about the legacy of black businesses in Baltimore's Mount Vernon neighborhood. So that's on the way tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Paul Starobin, who has been reporting on Russia for Business Week and other publications for more than a quarter century. His new book explores the status of the estimated 1 million Russians who have left the country since the war in Ukraine began. It's called Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. You can join our conversation if you have a question for Paul Starobin, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Paul, you say that this is surely the best connected diaspora in human history. It's a lot of people, 1 million. They're all over the place. But one of the interesting facts that you report in this book is that Russia has not yet blocked YouTube. So there are ways of getting information from outside Russia in to Russia.
Yes.
How's that working?
It's a flood of information. I mean, you have a lot of YouTube channels. You have professional media outlets like TV Rain, known as Dosht, from Amsterdam. And you have, of course, all kinds of private people, bloggers and so forth. It's on YouTube. It's on Telegram in particular, which is probably the favorite platform used by a lot of Russians. And Putin has not blocked this. It's sort of a question why, but I think probably the answer is that Russians inside of Russia, I mean, you know, they love YouTube for, you know, their kids watch cartoons, all kinds of things other than political offerings. So that would be, you know, that would not be something that would be welcome for the Russian people. So Putin, I think there's really an information war that is essentially going on, which I think is part of a broader civil war that's taking place within the Russian society, both inside of Russia and outside of Russia. And so these information warriors are very much a part of that. Israel, I talked to one today. One of the leaders of the opposition is a young guy by the name of Maxim Katz, who claims to have several million YouTube subscribers. So yeah, the Russians, you know, they're pretty ingenious with a lot of these media tools, quite good at agitation and propaganda.
Yeah, as we certainly know here in the United States. I mean, they're
Yes.
awfully good at it. Yeah.
Well, they're good in every respect. That's right, Tom. I mean,
Yeah.
they're good, you know, however they're deployed. But trust me, the ones on the other side against Putin are every bit as creative and ingenious as the ones who, you know, the Kremlin is mobilizing against, you know, our elections in America.
Tell us a little bit more about TV Rain. You mentioned that they're now working out of Amsterdam. They were in
Yeah.
Latvia for a little while. These are Russian journalists who are waging a sort of, you know, information war against Putin. Tell us about you profile them extensively in the
Yeah.
book. Let's learn something about them.
Yeah, well, I think the larger context here, and I think it's unfortunate, is I don't think that in the West we have really seen the kind of asset that outlets like TV Rain present. It's not that well understood, but TV Rain formed as an independent station, a television station in Russia during the Putin time, not explicitly against Putin, but just to be an independent, you know, news gathering and source of commentary outlet. And they were pretty successful among people kind of young and hip that were part of their audience, a kind of an urban audience. But it became absolutely impossible with the all-out invasion of 2 years ago. It literally, as you mentioned, became a crime to even say that there was a war going on. So just an intolerable situation for any independent journalist. The TV Rain people initially fled mostly to Latvia, to the capital of Riga, and they were registered to operate there, but they see themselves as umbilically part of this larger Russian society, including Russians back home. So it actually became a kind of duel of pronouns. You know, the TV Rain people in Latvia would call the Russian troops and the Russian people back in Russia, you know, we are all part of the community. The Latvians wanted a they. And these kinds of issues sort of intensified to the point that the Latvian authorities, the regulators, pulled the license, and the TV Rain people had to relocate in Amsterdam, where they're now operating under a new license. It's very difficult for them to make any money because you can't monetize your audience back in Russia, so they depend a lot on donations and that kind of thing. But you know, they are a steady stream of commentary. When Navalny died, I mean, they were on it immediately. So yeah, I mean, they're one example, one of the most prominent examples of that kind of media. You have the outlet Medusa, in which is still in Riga. I guess they've been perhaps somewhat more careful, but they're a terrific, you know, an authoritative source of information about what's happening. So Putin has to contend with this thicket, as I think it's underappreciated by folks in the West. You know, the White House certainly has identified with Navalny's cause and now with his widow, but I'm not sure that they have a broader understanding of just, you know, all of the facets of this Russian opposition in exile.
And you quote Vera Krishkevskaya. Am I saying her name right? Krishkevskaya,
Kucheskaya,
yeah, who's a co-founder of TV Rain,
Yes, she is.
saying that a lot of people in Russia didn't know what was going on in Ukraine, and it wasn't until they got the knock on the door and were told they had to mobilize and go, you know, join the army and be on the front, that they realized what was going on. So it still takes a while, I would imagine, for an outlet like TV Rain to penetrate you know, the information landscape in any significant way.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're feeling, and I would, you know, visited with some TV Rain journalists in Tbilisi in Georgia, the capital of Georgia, because they also have a studio there. And, you know, one of them said, well, my grandmother, you know, my grandfather, he's kind of a zombie. I think we've lost him, but I still have hope for my grandmother. So, you know, there are people who are inside of Russia, particularly among the older generation, that are, yeah, they were brought up with Soviet-era television, this kind of transition that we now have in the Putin time of state-controlled media that is basically, you know, just all favorable to whatever is happening at the level of Putin and the Kremlin. You know, those people are sort of buying that. But then underneath that, there are so many other sources of information. So I think the potential there is to reach those people. It's not easy, as you say. And if you have an event like a mobilization, that can sort of, you know, ripen the ground so that the message can be better received. And we'll see what's going to be happening in coming, you know, days, weeks, and months. I mean, we have Navalny's funeral coming up, I think probably this week. We'll see. I don't think it could be too long. And we'll see, you know, I'm sure that the information warriors against Putin will be all over that. And we'll see if they get their message through in some way to people on the ground in Russia.
Yeah, you do say that the level of viewership now is magnitude orders of magnitude higher than the following that they had pre-exile. So certainly a lot of people are taking notice, and the funeral clearly is going to be a problem for Putin. Navalny's mother seemed to stand pretty fast about not putting up with the original demands of the Russian government to keep the funeral private.
Right.
Do we know anything about the condition of the body? I mean, is an autopsy something that is ever going to be made, you know, credibly public? Will there be a Do you expect that it'll be a public event, this funeral for Alexei Navalny, and do you think people will come out and physically be noticed among the crowd supporting him?
Yeah, when Prigozhin, the warlord whose plane almost was brought down almost certainly by an act of the security services, the Russian security services, had his funeral, it was pretty much of a private affair. I expect that they will try to keep it that way, the Kremlin. But it could be that word leaks out as well. I mean, what we've learned about these things, and it also relates to the initial, you know, the poisoning, the attempted assassination of Alexei Navalny, is that it's actually pretty difficult in the end to keep all this information private. So I don't think we're going to learn immediately the exact circumstances of Navalny's death, you know, the autopsy and so forth, that undoubtedly must have been done, but at least by the official authorities. I don't think they're going to allow any sort of second autopsy by people connected to the Navalny family, doctors and so forth. But eventually it leaks out. I mean, the opposition is really clever in extracting information out of Russia. And, you know, there's different disinformation and feints and so forth on both sides. So we'll see, you know, how that kind of cat and mouse game proceeds.
The book is called Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. The author is my guest, Paul Steribin. He's the former Moscow bureau chief for Business Week and a longtime observer of Russia for a number of publications. So, Paul, talk about the level of support that Vladimir Putin does enjoy. You mentioned the person you profiled who said, well, I may have lost my grandmother, but or I think I can save my grandmother, although I may have lost my grandfather. Is it a generational thing? Because there are a number of exiles you talk about in the book who have been disowned and abandoned by their families. And so that adds an extra layer of, you know, emotional angst to their decision to leave. Is there a way of knowing how the Russian public thinks about this war? There are a couple of polls that you cite. I mean, what about the credibility of, that kind of information? What data can we be confident in?
Yeah, I don't know that we can be confident of any of the data. I mean, there is a polling organization, the Levada organization in Russia, which has existed for a long time and I think is credible. But, you know, they literally will sit down with people to visit the people's homes to try to get opinion. But I think it's tough now because, look, Tom, if I were now in Russia and I went out into the public square in some provincial town and I had a blue and yellow, you know, balloon in the colors of the Ukrainian flag, the cornflower yellow, and I voted, I would be reported and I'm sure the prosecutors would be on my case. I'd be at the very least detained. I mean, you cannot show that kind of public opposition. And I think Russians are very suspicious. So even of pollsters, I think it's difficult to know. But I do think the generational theme is an important one. And I was struck by it continually in the interviews, the time that I spent with exiles in places like Yerevan and Tbilisi. I mean, one person's story, for example, a young woman called Nastya, she had grown up in a village in northwestern Russia, her mother, you know, this is the time of Putin, said, you know, do not get involved in politics. It's just not good for you. She went to the medical institute in St. Petersburg studying neurology. There were anti-Putin demonstrations, but she kept out of them. You know, when I met with her, she told me she would rather, you know, put a gun to her head rather, you know, than give up her medical degree. And yet when the war came, it was a crisis of conscience. She felt guilty about what was being done. She fled with her husband. She was learning Ukrainian, and she came out. She participated in an anti-Putin street protest in Yerevan. Her mother, rather incredibly, saw her on Russian state television because they were filming it, called her up, screamed at her, you know, you're an enemy of the state. You're probably being paid by the, you know, the anti-Putin crowd, which, of course, is not true. And eventually they reconciled. But, you know, this kind of generational divide is really quite striking. And so I think you would, to circle back to your question, I think you would locate, you know, to the extent that there is a Putin opposition, I think you would probably locate it amongst the younger generations in Russia. And it may not be loud because it can't be at this time, but I don't think this is a popular war. And we have, in fact, seen Russian mothers and wives whose, you know, sons and husbands are on the front lines asking, you know, why aren't they being relieved? You know, why do they have to stay there so long? And so, you know, Russian mothers are pretty tough. And I think Putin has a potentially formidable adversary in those Russian mothers.
Indeed. In terms of general world support for the exile community, you mentioned that the diaspora community of exiles from Russia is at least connected through social media. I mean, they have a fair amount of different ways of staying up to date with what's going on. You mentioned that some journalists from Russia who are in exile do get grants, actually, from things like the U.S. Russian Foundation, the Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty Prague,
yes,
which are groups funded by the U.S. government. But is there, you know, financial and moral support coming to the exile community? Is this a tool, an anti-Putin tool that people outside of Russia are using to oppose Putin?
To some degree, but probably not as much as, you know, one could imagine it becoming. And it's a little bit tricky. I mean, for Russians outside of Russia who have money to donate to these, you know, Russian organizations and exile outlets like TV Rain and so forth, that's one thing, and that would be completely understood. For the United States government to get involved directly is tricky because it could play into Putin's efforts to paint the exiles in opposition as mere tools, you know, of the West, of NATO, and so forth. So it is a bit tricky in those grounds. I think most of these exile organizations are feeling somewhat starved, you know, for funding. So they're doing the best they can. There is a unit, we haven't talked about this, but there is a unit inside of Ukraine, the Free Russia Legion, which is actually fighting against regular Russian army troops. And they're being sustained by the Ukrainian armed forces and the government in Kyiv.
Yeah, they're actually assisting the Ukrainian military in the war, and they're out to kill Russian soldiers who are in Ukraine. If at some point Putin is deposed, whether it's violently or through political means, is there the chance that whoever succeeds him will be even worse? I mean, do we have any sense of what would be next in the next chapter for Russia after Putin?
We probably do, but I think the person to interview there would be Bill Burns, the director of the CIA in Washington, who is the most experienced Russia hand that we have in the government now in Washington. And I said in my book, I would love to be able to talk to him about that. He has said, somewhat cryptically, of course, he's the director of the CIA, that never has their human intelligence been better inside of Russia and Moscow, but which I assume he means that they have, you know, people who are, you know, cluing our intelligence community in as to who the next, you know, Putin might be, or at least what the circumstances are. I mean, Putin has essentially consolidated support among the group that's known as the Siloviki, the men of power, who are largely people like himself with an ex, you know, KGB or security services background. So I think as long as he retains their support, he's unlikely to be deposed. But all bets are off if there's a post-Putin, well, there will be a post-Putin period. We don't know when it will take place. He's 71 years old. But I would say all bets are off. I mean, the history of change in Russia is that it can come suddenly and violently. And we don't know necessarily what will come next. It may not be another Putin. That's a possibility. But it could be an entirely different figure. And it depends, of course, on where the Russian people are. These opposition folks in exile that we are talking about are doing quite a bit of agitation, and they're seeding the ground, they hope, for a post-Putin future for Russia, as well as being kind of custodians of what that future might look like, which they largely see as democratic and not the autocracy that has afflicted Russia for so many centuries.
Paul Starobin, his new book is called Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. We'll continue our conversation after a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
The New York Times and others are reporting that before Russian authorities announced the death of Alexei Navalny on February 16th, he was on the verge of being freed in a prisoner swap with Germany. An aide to Mr. Navalny said their talks were underway to free Navalny and perhaps even Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich and former Marine Paul Whelan in exchange for Vadim Krasikov, who was convicted of killing a separatist fighter from Chechnya in Berlin in 2019. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Paul Starobin. He talked about this report of a prisoner exchange that could have involved Alexei Navalny a little earlier in the program. He's a former Moscow bureau chief for Business Week, and we're talking about his latest book, Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. You are welcome to join our conversation with Paul Starobin, 410-662-8780, or our email, midday@wypr.org. So with this Free Russian Legion, Paul, this unit of Russian soldiers fighting under the flag of Ukraine, is that something that are they trusted? I know you've been in touch with them even recently since the publication of the book. Are they trusted within Ukraine? Is there an opportunity for that particular part of the movement to grow?
Well, I think there is. I think the question that's more in my mind is, are they trusted within the Russian opposition community?
Yeah,
because there's a real split now. I mean, I post Navalny's death, I am dividing the opposition increasingly into two separate wings. One wing is about this kind of agitation and hope for change that we've talked about. And the other wing is just explicitly militant, and who believes that Putin must be challenged by force, you know, by military, by violent force. And that's the Free Russia Legion. And I talked today, for example, to the person who is basically the head of the political wing, who's based in Kiev. He's a Russian, he's a former parliamentarian. And he told me that since Navalny's death, they've been getting more traffic expressions of interest in joining the Legion from people who were associated with Navalny. So I think there is the likelihood that the opposition is now going to take a more militant and violent turn, but it's going to be very controversial because there are a lot of people in exile who simply do not believe in that, and they think it's likely to be fruitless and it could be counterproductive. But that's certainly not what the Legion people think. I also talked to a Legion volunteer on the ground in Ukraine, you know, now fighting, and he also exuded some confidence. You know, they're making, in some cases, some border raids across Russia. They can't stay there. They establish a beachhead. They don't have artillery and so forth. But I do believe there is an active fighting force. Difficult to say exactly how big it is. They're not giving out that information, but it is under the umbrella of the Ukrainian armed forces. And so certainly they think, if nothing else, it's a good public relations tool to show that not all Russians are for Putin.
I was fascinated to read about the religious dimension of this story. You have a chapter called The Spiritual Resistance. And you talk to a priest or two from the Russian Orthodox Church who are in exile. But there is great tension between the secular element of the Russian exile community and the Russian Orthodox Church. And then there seems to be an evolution of the position of the Russian Orthodox Church in Russian society from what you call patriotic orthodoxy, which you write that it blossomed into a kind of state ideology which replaced the scientific atheism that even the KGB at one point had embraced. So Navalny, you mentioned earlier, you know, declared himself to be a Christian, and Putin's take on religion and the role of the church has certainly evolved over the years, hasn't it?
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack there, but essentially in the Soviet time, the party organ, the Communist Party and the KGB aligned itself against religion because, you know, under the Marxist formula, it was the opiate of the masses. But I think KGB people came to see that as a mistake because they really couldn't eradicate religion and spiritual belief. And I think Putin in particular, and there's some disagreement among experts about whether he has a genuine, you know, Orthodox belief or not. I once, by the way, talked to a person who described himself, or at least was said to be the person that Putin confessed to. He was a priest at a monastery not far from the old KGB headquarters in Moscow, Lubyanka. But in any case, whatever Putin's disposition, Putin clearly saw a strategic value in aligning himself with the Russian Orthodox Church, and particularly the Patriarch, who Patriarch Kirill right now is one of the leading exponents and really voices of justification for the war in Ukraine, which he terms to be basically a holy war. But the church is a complicated institution. And I talked to, for example, Father Oleg, a priest, and his wife. They're permitted to marry in Batumi by the Black Sore Sea in Georgia. And, you know, he fled from his church in Moscow in opposition to the war. And there's a lot of spiritual resistance among such people. And I'm told, I think quite reliably, that there are bishops, even in the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia, who are against the war, but they can't express themselves. So it's really quite an issue. There's a lot of ferment there. But part of the tragedy, I think, is that the opposition is largely of a secularized nature, particularly in Europe. And they have not really recognized, I think, this sort of dissent that is within the Russian Orthodox Church. And, you know, in surveys, these I do take to be fairly reliable. Not that many Russians will go to church, but upwards of 70% say that they have a belief in God, which, you know, tells you something. I mean, this is not Sweden or, for example. So I think for the Russian opposition to be really effective, they have to in some way, you know, capture those people. And Navalny, you know, I am a Christian. I mean, he absolutely realized that was, you know, one way to communicate to the flock, as it were. And he was really kind of a living martyr while he was in jail. And now among believers, he's considered to be a true martyr. I've seen journal entries, for example, from Lake Baikal in Siberia among believers who now hail Navalny and say he still lives. You know, it's a Christ-like, you know, Christian parable.
Yeah, well, you know, religion almost always plays a role in these kinds of conflicts, and this Russia situation certainly no different. We have a question from a listener, Wayne, who says, can you address the relationship between Trump and Putin? What's your take on that relationship? It seems that Mr. Trump is awfully accommodating to Mr. Putin and has been for some years.
Right. And I wish I had a degree in psychology to answer that one. you know, I tend to reject the sort of simple kind of conspiracy theory explanation, which is that Putin has something, you know, on Trump that he's using to blackmail him, some piece of, you know, dirty information or financial or whatever. I tend to reject that. My sense of Trump is just as a disposition. He likes all of these authoritarian leaders, as we've seen, even the leader of North Korea, of China. Maybe there's some sense that of jealousy or envy that, you know, he has not attained such powers. Probably he sees Putin as somebody who is fairly successful in those terms and admires what Putin has been able to accomplish in Russia. And you know, virtually unchallenged rule now for 25 years. So I see it in those terms rather than Putin having something on Trump that forces Trump to be compliant.
And clearly Putin has a vested interest in Mr. Trump being reelected or being elected for a second time in 2024. I mean, he's got to be jumping up and down and dancing when he looks at the House of Representatives and, you know, the fact that they're stalling the support for Ukraine resistance. What do you expect in terms of Russian involvement in the 2024 election, given the war is a new dimension in that calculation, you know, that wasn't happening, you know, in 2016?
Yeah, so there I see a lot of continuity, and probably Putin's own training as a KGB officer comes into play. I mean, during the Soviet period, the 1960s, for example, there was a very active disinformation campaign. Both the Soviet, the KGB types, and the FBI were interested in sort of learning about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And, you know, the Soviets saw it as a form of, you know, useful agitation that would help divide American society. And I think that's basically what they're always off after, anything that can divide. And so I think with respect to the war, if there are voices in America, such as in the House of Representatives, among Republicans, Tucker Carlson and so forth, that are effectively pro-Russia, even if they don't explicitly state that, or at least anti-aiding Ukraine, then yeah, that's exactly what they want. The only caveat I would put to that is that Trump is a rather impulsive and unpredictable creature. So yeah, he would probably be welcomed by Putin. Certainly anything that Trump did to kind of further divide NATO, you know, strip funding or compromise, you know, the Article 5 pledge to come to the aid of NATO countries that are attacked by Russia or by anyone, he would welcome that. But he probably, in some part of him, P. Putin, regards Trump as being, kind of a live wire. You just don't know exactly what you're going to get.
We're out of time, basically, but I want to ask you to answer quickly if there is a predictable successor to Alexei Navalny. We heard news today of Oleg Orlov, who's part of this memorial group. They won a Nobel Prize. He was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for speaking out against the war in Ukraine. Is there a natural successor to Navalny?
Well, his wife, Yulia, has basically put herself in that station, but I think it remains to be seen, because Yulia has always been very supportive of Alexei, but she did not really occupy an active role as leader of the organization. And so this is new for her. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that role will necessarily be accepted by others in the opposition, which is fairly sprawling, and who may have, you know, their own, you know, plans to advance themselves. So mm-hmm. I think that's very much an open question. I don't think there really is at this point an obvious successor. I think it's more like there's a vacuum.
Well, Paul Starobin, thank you so much, and congratulations on the book. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
The new book is called Putin's Exile, Their Fight for a Better Russia. Tomorrow, it's Smart Nutrition with Monica Reinagle, and Midday in the Neighborhood with Nick Thieme of the Baltimore Banner. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.